Nolan. Ms. Lovett.
May it please the court, this case concerns a state...
You can drop the whole podium.
That's
a little switch that will move it down.
I can see you. This case concerns a state court clerk's unconstitutional rejection of a pro se divorce petition and temporary restraining order. Before addressing that underlying constitutional issue, however, I'll address first the question of whether Mr. Snyder, the pro se appellant, or until this point, pro se appellant, has waived his right to appeal. Under this court's decision in Video Views versus Studio 21, a party's failure to object to a magistrate judge's report within 10 days of service of the report waives his right to object to the report on appeal. There's no dispute that Mr. Snyder did not object to the magistrate's report in this case.
Is there any indication that he was unaware of the requirement?
Not of the requirement. He was aware. He had already received a magistrate's report on his prior, his first amended complaint, so he knew of the rule. But he didn't have actual notice of when the rule started to run. You know, at some level, knowing that you have to file within 10 days is only meaningful if you know when to start counting. And in this case, Mr. Snyder did know when to start counting. He was under the impression that the magistrate judge had not ruled and did not find out about the ruling until actually after dismissal was entered.
In this timing, when did he learn? Was it a transfer that caused the problem?
It wasn't an official transfer. He was on writ status. Essentially, he had a fitness hearing in his underlying criminal conviction, and he didn't know how long he was going to be gone. He thought it would only be for 7 days, so he asked the head of the Shawnee Correctional Facility to forward his mail, and the mail wasn't forwarded, and in fact was held for 2 months in violation of the state code. And I think what these are getting at is the fact that video views is a non-jurisdictional rule. And this case, this court can and has, in past cases, found an exception to the non-jurisdictional rule in the interest of justice. And I think in this case, there's an unusual confluence of factors that, when taken together, make a very fact-bound reason for making an exception to video views in this case. First is that Mr. Snyder, unlike most pro ses, has been incredibly diligent in this case. He's filed 3 complaints, 2 oppositions to motions to dismiss, an extension when he thought he was going to be late, an objection to the magistrate's report on the first amended complaint, and a timely notice of appeal, a motion to vacate. There's only one time he missed timeliness, and that was because he didn't actually have the magistrate's report in front of him. There's also no assertion of prejudice in this case. Nolan has not claimed that he was prejudiced by the delay, and I don't believe he can, because all of the arguments have been previewed in the series of oppositions to the motions to dismiss and the objections to the magistrate's report on the first amended complaint. In addition, and I think this is what your question was getting to, that there's no actual notice. And this is a key distinction between the other cases in which this court has strictly adhered to the rule in video views. In those cases, the parties knew of the magistrate's report and just decided not to file because they had a wedding to attend or thought that it wasn't necessary. In this case, there was no actual notice of when the filing requirement became due. And there's also no efficiency gain in this case. The writing's on the wall what the next case is going to be, and that's going to be the suit against the Shawnee Correctional Facility for holding the mail in violation of state law. And so this is just going to generate more litigation as opposed to less litigation if the court doesn't hear the merits of this case. And finally, I think there has been an excuse offered. There is a reason why there was...
I think the statute of limitations has already expired on your other proposed suit.
I think all of these factors, together with the merits of the case, would counsel in favor of this court.
Well, he has had at least a day in court before the magistrate.
He has had a day before the magistrate, but he hasn't had his day before an Article III court. You know, there's no indication in the district court's order that it even reviewed this for clear error, which under this court's decision in Kruger might be enough to reverse the district court alone. In Kruger, this court indicated, hey, even absent objections, you need to at least read the magistrate's report and look for clear error. And I think had there been, some search for clear error, the court would have found it in this case, because there's clearly no claim for absolute immunity, and I think there's no claim for qualified immunity here either.
Suppose we just throw all immunities, suppose we allow your client to challenge the magistrate's report, we throw all the immunities out the door. Where's the constitutional claim here?
Right,
if a state, my question is this, if a state court clerk does something wrong, why isn't it the appropriate step to take to complain to a state judge, either a judge of that court or a judge of the higher court with a peremptory writ? And I can't imagine if a clerk of the U.S. District Court erroneously returns a document that the right thing to do is file a suit for damages, you instead ask a judge to compel the clerk to file the document.
Well, I think your question is getting at two different things. It's asking about the alternative remedies in the case, and I think that question can be broken down further into, A, what's the role of the alternative remedy in the constitutional analysis, and B, was it adequate? And I think looking, liberally reading Mr. Snyder's complaint, it appears that he's alleging three independent constitutional violations, a right to petition under the First Amendment and incorporated under the 14th, a right to due process, which is the Logan-Hudson line of you took away my remedy without adequate process, and then a substantive due process. I think the alternate underboding. I think the question that you're asking about, which is the alternative remedy, addresses the second and the third.
Well, it addresses all of them. You can't call the outcome of litigation in state court a violation of the right to petition because something happened. If you go back and look at the original, everybody knows these days about the Rooker-Feldman Doctrine. If you actually read the Rooker case, what Rooker holds is that things that go wrong in the course of litigation in state court cannot be the basis for recovery on a constitutional tort theory. One must instead go to the higher state court. And this looks like something that is within the scope of the original holding of Rooker. This is something that went wrong in state litigation, and the right thing to do is complain within the state court system. That's all Rooker was ever originally about.
I think there are a couple of answers to that. First is that you're assuming that the alternative remedy that you're proposing, which is to go and get a writ of mandamus, would have been adequate. But in this case, Mr. Snyder is saying in his opposition papers that was a meaningless remedy. By that time, his wife had already sold the assets and was judgment proof, and it was an empty mandamus at that point. There was nothing he could do. And I think, second, it's not merely a case of something going wrong in the state court. He's also alleged that this was intentional misconduct by Mr. Nolan. And,
at
this point,
plaintiff and Rooker alleged the same thing, for what it's worth.
But I think also that the precedent in at least the other circuits, the Fifth Circuit in Jackson versus Procurier, actually recognized that this would amount to a constitutional violation if something's going wrong in the state process. Also in McRae versus Maryland, the Fourth Circuit found another violation under the right to petition. And so I think that there's precedent for this, and that what's happening here, which is there's really no remedy other than the damages claim in federal court. And when you take all those factors together, plus the fact that, Snyder can also claim that he's been deprived of the equitable remedy of a restraining order. He's lost that property right, and under Logan, that is a right for which he should be compensated and which the federal courts have allowed.
Now it sounds like that the claim amounts to saying, gee, there's this very important doctrine, the domestic relations exception to diversity jurisdiction, that confines domestic relations cases to state court. And your position seems to be that if something, however, goes wrong in the domestic relations litigation, then we'll litigate the domestic relations case in federal court.
But we're not litigating the domestic relations case. We're litigating...
We're necessarily litigating the domestic relations case. The holding of Christopher against Harbury last year is that in order to litigate some claim of not having access to the courts, one must litigate the underlying legal claim. Under Christopher, it is not possible to have this litigation without litigating a domestic relations case.
Well, the domestic relations dispute has already been settled. The divorce has been entered. This is not re-litigation of anything that happened in the divorce. It is now, the question is simply whether Mr. Snyder had the right to file his petition for divorce and temporary restraining order, and there's no dispute that it was procedurally proper. There's nothing about domestic relations law that this case implicates. And
it does, however. I mean, the holding of Christopher is that to obtain relief in a claim of this sort, one must litigate in federal court and win the underlying claim that says on which you were supposedly deprived of the opportunity to litigate in the other court system. You must litigate and win a domestic relations claim. That's, Christopher says, an essential part of what litigation of this kind would have to be about. Well, that's one reason, by the way, why Harbury lost Christopher against Harbury.
Well, in Bell, however, the court indicated that you don't actually have to prove that it's a meritorious.
The Supreme Court did not wholly agree with our position in Bell.
And I think that at least in Harrell, more recently, the court has addressed some of those issues. And I think at this point, there is no dispute about the underlying legal claim that Mr. Snyder did have a valid petition for divorce. He did have a valid claim to the assets. Those aren't in dispute. And so I don't think that you're going to necessarily have to relitigate any of the domestic issues in this case.
Thank you, Ms. Leavitt.
Thank you.
Mr. Cook.
May it please the court. Mr. Snyder was certainly aware of the requirement that he keep the court advised of his status and his whereabouts. He had an order to that effect. It was in effect for quite a while, for more than a year, as I recall. And he so advised the court.
Do you think federal courts would be better off if we adopted a rule compelling prisoners to pepper the federal courts with paper every time they get move from one institution to another for a 7-day period or a 10-day period?
Prisoners pepper federal courts with paper all the time.
Yes, I know, and usually we try very hard to get them to stop. Your view seems to be to say the big problem is the prisoners aren't filing enough paper in federal district courts.
No, sir. When
they should be instructed to file more.
No, sir. When I serve my papers, I'd like to know that the plaintiff who is incarcerated actually gets those papers. He didn't tell me where he was either. I think the court, in fairness to the court, can expect that the parties, all parties, will keep the court.
Let me tell you my worries. Prisoners get picked up, often with no advance notice, and yanked to other institutions on writs all the time, for mental examination to try in some other case. The implication of your position is that as soon as that happens, maybe on the prison bus, they should be filing change of address forms, even if they're not quite clear where they're going. And then when they get brought back 2 days later or 7 days later, they should file another change of address form. Isn't it more sensible as an institutional matter to say for short transfers, it's okay to rely on the prison to forward the mail, rather than have two change of address forms in the
district?
It is
not my rule, Your Honor, that requires prisoners to advise the court of their changes of address. I am only suggesting that the rule of video views be followed in this case. This court,
well, the video,
other court.
Video views doesn't cover this. This was not the question in video views. We're now trying to figure out what is a sensible policy to deal with people who are moved involuntarily for short periods.
I think
now maybe we should adopt as a sensible policy file more paper with the district court, but it's not clear to me that that's the best policy.
What would be the downside of having an exception under these circumstances, as we do in habeas and other areas, an exception to the rule of filing within 10 days?
If the litigant advises the court at some point that he has been transferred, that could work. But where the court takes action during this interim period where they're not aware of where the party is, then it seems to me that it is utterly uneconomic to have any kind of exception that that essentially nullifies the action taken by the district court. The district court, I believe, has an appropriate right to rely on the litigant, whether he's incarcerated or not, to tell the court where they are located. And that is a chronic problem when litigants don't do that. I've had that happen in many cases that I've been involved in, and frequently the district court in the Southern District where I practice will delay taking action if they're not quite sure where a party is. In this case, I don't believe this is the case for crafting such an exception, Your Honor. And I say that because there is no fundamental injustice here. And let me take a moment to explain that, if I might. First of all, it was the plaintiff's obligation to advise the court of his change of address. He did not. It's very clear that he did not. When Magistrate Cohn issued his second report and recommendation, there was no objection to that. It went before Judge Beatty, Judge Beatty issued an order adopting the report and recommendation. After that, the plaintiff came in and did not file an objection, or did not try to file an objection. He didn't tender an objection to the court. Instead, he asked for additional time to do that. Yes, the court already had, as counsel has properly conceded, the court also had the argument that the plaintiff was going to make on these points. The plaintiff previously had filed an objection to the earlier report and recommendation of the magistrate. Having all this in the record, Judge Beatty, when presented with a notice of appeal or alternative motion to vacate the order, the judgment order that he had entered, Judge Beatty indicated in his order that he reviewed the record and found no clear error in his ruling, and therefore declined to vacate the order and judgment. Under these circumstances, no argument can be made. No argument really is being made, I don't believe, here, that there's been some fundamental injustice because Judge Beatty did not impose sanctions on the plaintiff, did not dismiss for want of prosecution. He considered everything in the record, and he agreed with the magistrate that there was no constitutional tort and that quasi-judicial immunity applied, and also
those
qualified
different
immunity
points.
Applied.
I thought that
they're
was
different
the
points.
Latter. I thought the magistrate judge's view was the latter, that there was immunity.
That there was immunity, yes. I didn't mean to suggest that he ruled to the contrary. Judge Beatty adopted the magistrate's report and recommendation.
The bottom line, the judgment entered in this case was a judgment on the merits.
Yes, sir, it was. And under those circumstances, the plaintiff is not in a position to argue that somehow the district court has not considered the arguments he was raising. And under these circumstances, I would suggest to the court that there's been no damage or no injustice. I expected Judge Ripple to ask me about Kincaid versus Vail, and your opinion some years ago, I think in 1992. And from my perspective, this case really turns on Kincaid versus Vail, and that is whether this circuit will adopt the rule that circuit clerk's action in my client, the circuit clerk's action in sending back the plaintiff's divorce papers was protected by the doctrine of quasi-judicial immunity. After all, there was no judge's direction that the clerk was following, or precise, explicit direction that the clerk was following.
Well, what does Illinois expect litigants to do in this position?
File a petition for writ of mandamus, and if necessary, seek damages. That can be done under Illinois law. It is permitted. And that's the remedy.
Damages on what theory?
if he has been damaged in some respect, if he, I believe he alleged here that his wife dissipated his assets and got rid of his dog.
Now I'm puzzled. If erroneous action by a clerk in refusing to file papers is a source of damages under Illinois law, what sense would it make to say that there is any kind of immunity
that
in a federal suit? We're just arguing then about venue.
We're arguing not about venue. We're arguing about whether a constitutional tort, a federal constitutional tort,
now, that's not the immunity question. The immunity question supposes that there's a constitutional tort. You know, I was asking Ms. Lovett whether that supposition was correct. But for immunity to make sense, we would have to suppose that there was not only a tort, but a constitutional tort.
For quasi-judicial immunity, not qualified immunity.
Skip the names. My question to you was, what's the functional justification for creating an immunity if the same action is already subject to damages under state law? Other than venue is at issue?
I'm not suggesting that my client is liable for damages under state law. I am suggesting to the court that there is a state law, a remedy under state law, that the plaintiff could seek a writ of mandamus compelling him to file these papers, and if damages have been incurred, he can ask in the state court action for damages. That is permitted. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Mr. Cook. And thank you, Ms. Lovett. We greatly appreciate your willingness to accept the appointment in this case, and you've been of assistance to both your client and to the court. The case will be taken under advisement, and the court will be in recess until about 3 weeks from now. Actually, until Monday.
Yeah.
Sorry. I didn't want to dismiss the court for an entire 3 weeks.